Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, a happy Friday. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Juma Mubarak, whatever it may be in your happy Friday. It's the end of the week, and, well, not for me. I've got to write a book this weekend or finish writing a book. But anyway, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Bernie Sanders with us as well. Of course, it's Friday. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls on the topic of your choice. 866-303-2270 is our toll-free number all across the United States and in most places in the world. And Bernie's website, of course, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter. You can catch the news of the day there. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. Good morning, Bernie.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Or actually,
did you just say you were going to write a book this weekend?
I was supposed to have the thing finished by August 1st, and I've been working on it for a year.
That's what I love about you. I don't know where you get all of this energy to do all these things, but
I'm a hyperactive kid who grew up, Bernie. It's true. It's really true. So anyway, I'm working on that. But you're in district. You're back in Vermont because you're doing town hall meetings.
A lot of things. We are for a start, we're going to be doing a couple of meetings in the state of Vermont on the Obama campaign. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me to be terribly important. In the midst of all of the media gossip and the 10-second sound bites, that we do something that is not being done enough, and that is just take a hard look at the problems facing our country, get an understanding of the voting records and what McCain and Obama are saying, and see which candidate better addresses the needs of the American people. And I think when you do that, the answer is quite clear that it will be Barack Obama, big time. But I get very concerned about how media deals with campaign sees it as something like a baseball game. The vast majority of the writing and the TV deals with political gossip, 30-second ads, and so forth. And yet, if you understand the fact that we are living through the end of the worst administration in the modern history of America, if we are living at a time when in almost every single direction that you can think of, whether it is the economy, whether it is energy, whether it is healthcare, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's global warming, whether it's the environment, whether it's the national debt, you name it, that in every single area, we have had a president taking us in the wrong direction, and you have John McCain, whose views on all of these issues are very, very close to George Bush. And the real question that we have to ask ourselves is why Obama is not 20 or 25 points ahead in this election. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact of how we do politics in this country and that we focus more on gossip and negativity than we do in looking at what candidates have done and are proposing to address the real issues facing America.
Yeah, I lay this at the feet of the corporate media, and I'll tell you, Robert Perry wrote a great piece you can find over at commondreams.org and on consortiumnews.com. He talks about how on Monday Obama gave this really detailed, rich speech on energy, called for this to be the end of the age of oil, talked about a whole bunch of different things that we should be doing, retrofitting the U.S. auto industry, limited offshore drilling, but energy innovation. And NBC News anchor Brian Williams devoted only 30 seconds to this thing, and without any of the details, his witty little line was that Obama is refining his energy plan, which plays into this corporate line of Obama as a flip-flopper. And then the other one that made me crazy was, the week before that, about the 200,000 people who showed up in Berlin, Obama said, and I quote, "It has become increasingly clear in my travel to campaign that the crowds, the enthusiasm, 200,000 people in Berlin, it is not about me at all. It's about America. I have just become a symbol." And they took out, they completely deleted the first two sentences where he said, "This is not about me at all. This is about people loving America." And they're playing this, "He's an elitist," which is translated down in the South into "He's uppity." And the corporate. And here's my question, Bernie. Chris Matthews, toward the end of the Hillary Obama thing, Chris Matthews candidly, twice actually, on the air, made the comment that his bosses at NBC wanted that thing to drag out as long as possible because it jacked up ratings.
Right.
Could it be, is it that the corporate media is giving short shrift to the actual issues here because they want to keep this a 50-50 race because that'll drive up ratings? Or could it be that they're giving short shrift to the issues because the issues in many cases are not friendly to big transnational corporations like General Electric?
It's both factors and more. I mean, I don't think we have to become paranoid. The corporate media is owned by the largest corporations, obviously, in this country, who are going to be sympathetic, by and large, to Republican positions of tax breaks for the rich and tax breaks for multinational corporations and so forth and so on.
Yeah, and the TV stars that they put on TV are multimillionaires themselves as
That's
well.
That's right. And in addition to that, the whole format of television now is to assume the American people are too stupid or would get bored if we had more than a 15 second soundbite. Mm-hmm. And that always works to Republican advantages because you can say over and over again, you know, "I'm for freedom, I'm for this, I'm for that," you know, and Ronald Reagan developed that to an extraordinary degree. Many of the major media, not just TV, but newspapers, are cutting back on their staff and have less and less, fewer and fewer people who are knowledgeable about real issues. And I think the Republicans have been very, very successful. I think this is a Karl Rove innovation to say, well, what's really important are not the issues. What's really important is, quote unquote, the character of the individual. Of course, character is important. But then what you do is you demonize people like John Kerry, you make fun of John Kerry, you make fun of Al Gore, you make fun of Barack Obama. So you, quote unquote, win the character debate, and you forget about all of the important issues facing the American people, which on issue by issue, the American people have long rejected what the Republicans stand for. Just to give you a few, John McCain is proposing huge tax breaks, bigger than Bush, expanding what Bush did in terms of tax breaks for the very, very richest people in this country. McCain wants to virtually repeal the estate tax, which provides close to $1 trillion in tax breaks to the wealthiest 0.3%, driving up the national debt that we'll leave to our kids and our grandchildren. And then he says he wants to move to a balanced budget. Well, how do you do that? You're going to cut back on many of the programs, education, health care, and environment that the middle class and working families of this country desperately need. Are we discussing that issue at much length? I think not. In terms of health care, Obama is talking about what we certainly should be doing is providing health care to every man, woman, and child in this country. I would go approach it in a different way than Obama, to be honest with you. But that's the concept that he's talking about. McCain essentially wants to continue the Bush disastrous free market approach to health care, which has led us to 8 million more people without health insurance in recent years. McCain has, at times in his career, voted against raising the minimum wage. In fact, most Americans think not only that we need a strong federal minimum wage, it has to go higher than it is right now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what a campaign is supposed to be, and by the way, I know, you know, McCain a bit, not very well. He's a decent guy. But the issue has got to be a debate on the issues facing the ordinary people of this country. And I think if we can focus on that, it's going to be Obama by a heck of a lot. If the Republicans are successful in using the Karl Rovian tactics of deflecting attention away from the real issues, the sinking middle class, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the disintegrating healthcare system, the increased national debt, our lowest standing in the international community because of the Iraq war, et cetera, et cetera. If they can deflect attention away from the real issues, I would say that McCain has a chance to win this election. So it seems to me that the real function that progressive activists have got to play is just to focus on the real issues, not get involved in gossip, not be attacking, you know, McCain for stupid reasons. Just let's look at the issues of what's happening in America, what the records are of McCain and Obama in the past. They both have records, and what they are proposing for the future. I think if you do that, it's Obama by a landslide. If we get deflected away from that, it could be a victory for McCain.
Yeah. I mean, this it is so much looking right now like this is going to be a replay of the Kerry thing and the Gore thing, where issues really, in the last two presidential elections, arguably in the last three or four presidential elections, issues have not been at the forefront.
And that's what, that is, in fact, that works for the Republicans' advantage. The less we know about what they believe, the better it is for them.
Yeah. It's Brunch with Bernie, our hour with Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls at 866-303-2270, sanders.senate.gov, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, 16 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Doesn't having a U.S. senator take your calls.
I have
it is great. Senator Bernie Sanders with us on the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, 866-303-2270. Bernie, take some calls.
Yep, ready to go.
Let's do it. Mike in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, you're on the line with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, hello. I'd like to talk about hearings that I watched on C-SPAN in late June with Maria Cantwell of Washington and Congressman Stupak from Michigan, the hearings they held on oil speculation, and I was just blown away by what we heard on there. And then in the media, it was completely turned around, and it was all about supply and demand, and they hardly ever talked about oil speculation. In fact, on NPR, the reporter on NPR actually made fun of it, and I was really impressed with the information and the experts that they had on those two panels. And where they talked about the Enron loophole that Phil Graham snuck into the legislation back in 2000 to deregulate the energy markets. And if I'm not mistaken, was Senator Sanders, were you on that committee with
Maria? Yeah. Well, I wasn't on the committee, but I've worked very closely with Maria Cantwell at Washington, who's done a great job on this issue. Others have been working on it as well. We met with economists from the University of Maryland, Dr. Greenberger, who made the point, along with a number of other people, by the way, including executives from the oil industry, who said that the fundamentals of the oil industry are such is that the price of a barrel of oil should be substantially less, by between 25 and 50% less. And all of these folks believe that speculation is playing a very, very significant role in driving up the price of oil. And one of the points that several of us have made is that when you talk about speculation, people say, well, you know, you're into paranoia, you're blaming the hedge funds, you're blaming Goldman Sachs and all of these guys. It's not really true. But if you look over what's happened just in the last 7 or 8 years, what do you think happened to electricity rates on the West Coast when Enron was involved in manipulating the market in the year 2000 and 2001? That was speculation. And then you had BP manipulating the propane gas market later on. They were fined $300 million. And then you had a hedge fund named Amaranth who were manipulating the natural gas market and driving gas prices up. And when that hedge fund dissolved because of investigations, prices went down there as well. So I think there is a lot of evidence, and we are working on legislation the Republicans have rejected over and over again, to, in fact, vigorously deal with speculation, and not only do away with the so-called Enron loophole that Phil Graham brought forth in 2000, but to make energy trading transparent, put it on on the radar screen, so that we can know if there is excessive speculation, if there is manipulation, if there is illegal activity. So I think the caller is exactly right. Speculation is a huge issue, which our Republican friends sometimes give lip service to, but certainly do not want to vigorously go after. And the other area that our Republican friends, of course, do not want to talk about is the huge profits that the oil companies are making. The idea to believe that the oil companies in this country, Exxon, Occidental, Shell, Conoco, that these companies, which have made huge record-breaking profits, care one whit about the average American. We are going to trust them. The real problem is they just don't have enough area to explore and drill on. Boy, give me a break. I can't believe that anyone really believes that. The oil companies now have some 62 million acres of federal land available to them for exploration. And you know what they've been doing? They haven't been exploring. What they have been doing is buying back their own stock. Most of their huge profits go not to developing new technology, not to buying new equipment, not to drilling, but to buying back their own stock and raising the prices of those stocks. So I think the Republicans, of course, don't want to deal with the greed of the oil industry, with the energy plan that Vice President Cheney developed early on in the Bush administration, which is significantly developed by the oil companies, and want to talk about a lot of other things.
Yeah. My suggestion to the Democratic Party is that they should get every Democrat in every state, any elected Democrats they can, to find where these 10,000 oil leases that have been given to the oil companies are, and that they should do nationwide on one day a giant photo op where thousands of elected Democratic officials are standing on top of, you know, open fields and whatever, you know, where they could be drilling, with a big sign that says drill here with an arrow pointing down, you know, pointing out the fact that there's 10,000 leases that have already been granted that the oil companies are not drilling.
And the other point as well is that while we obviously have got to deal with these outrageously high energy prices, which are causing real, real problems for people who have to drive any distances to work, or and we are very worried about what's going to happen here in New England and the northern part of this country with high oil prices, we also have got to understand that we must move away from fossil fuels. We must move to sustainable energy and energy efficiency. And the very, very good news, and I know I've talked about this repeatedly on this program, is that we now have the technology to do that, both in terms of energy efficiency. We should be having cars on the road, hybrid plug-ins, electric cars, which, you know, in the case of hybrid plug-ins can get 150 miles per gallon, electric cars, which have a range of several hundred miles, mass transportation, railroads, buses in rural areas. That is where we have got to be moving in addition.
Yeah, absolutely. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, Sanders.Senate.gov. 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. And Bernie, Freddie in Miami, Florida, listening on Winds, is on the line. Freddie, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Tom, for the opportunity. And Senator Sanders, my concern is... my question, primary question to you would be, how long do you expect the U.S. corporations to continue massive layoff? I have some sort of evidence that I can share with all your listeners. On CBSNews.com, the business section of it, if you were to go there, there's a link pointing to the state of the economy. And if you follow that link, it'll take you to employment in America. And if you follow that link, it'll take you to the pink layoff parade. Let me give you some numbers here real quick. I know you don't have all day to talk to me, but let me give you some quick numbers. In July of 2008, we have 2,500 layoffs in Northwest Airlines, Citigroup, 13,200, Continental, 3,000 in June 2008, United Airlines, 1,500, Lehman Brothers, 1,425.
And we get the idea, Freddie.
Freddie, you make a very, very important point. And what I mentioned earlier is these are exactly the issues that we should be talking about. I think everybody knows that unemployment is going up rapidly. We also know that inflation is going up. We know not only that we are losing many jobs, what we have seen over the last number of years is the loss of good-paying jobs and their replacement by lower-paying jobs. One example of that, which kind of tells us a whole lot, is that 25 years ago, General Motors was the largest employer in America, paying people good wages, good benefits, strong union. Today, Walmart, low wages, minimal benefits, vehemently anti-union. So unemployment, as Freddie indicates, is going up in almost every area of the country. And we're losing good paying jobs. And that takes us to just a whole lot of areas, not the least of which is our current trade policies, in which, in my view, it is very clear that trade agreements, with China, with Mexico, with other developing countries have encouraged corporations to throw, American workers out on the street and move abroad where they're paying people pennies, an hour. That, by the way, is another very key difference between Obama and McCain. But Freddie is absolutely right. I mean, the state of the economy and the loss of jobs is as important an issue as there is out there.
Ed, in Culver City, California, you're listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Is that Ed?
That's Ed. That's
hey,
you.
Senator.
Hey, Ed.
To help reduce the flow of people from Capitol Hill and the Pentagon to K Street, would you support any legislation to suspend the pension and health benefits of any of those people who become a registered lobbyist?
Now, I don't know that you can do that, but what you can do, and what I am supporting, is increasing the amount of time, the amount of time before somebody can leave Capitol Hill and become a lobbyist, and I think that's a successful way to do it.
That actually may be more effective. I mean, Billy Towson went to a $2 million a year job over
right.
at pharma. I mean, he's not going to worry about a $30,000 a year pension or something like that. Or,
that's right.
You know, or
right.
health benefits.
But the point that Ed makes is one of the, when we talk, for example, about the high cost of energy and the fact that ExxonMobil is making huge profits, record-breaking profits, and the fact that under the Republicans, ExxonMobil was given and other oil companies were given tax breaks. So how do you give tax breaks to hugely profitable oil companies? What sense is that? Well, then you start thinking, you say, over the last decade or so, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars have gone into lobbying from the large oil companies and coal companies. And then you understand that there are many, many, many hundreds of well-paid lobbyists, including former leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties, who are lobbying now for the pharmaceutical industry and for the banks and so forth and so on. So I think Ed puts his finger on a very important issue, that you're seeing a revolving door. People leave Congress, they become lobbyists, and they go talking to their pals, and they get legislation favorable to big special interests. And that's an issue we have to deal with. I'm not sure that Ed's approach is necessarily the best, though.
Dan in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Senator. Good to talk to you again. Guys, I wanted to bring to your attention, a friend of mine about a week ago sent me a link to an article on MIT's website about a major breakthrough in solar power, something that they're even calling the unleashing of the solar power era. The big problem that they were having before was that you know, solar power was so expensive to store because they were having problems storing it at night. Well, apparently they've come up with a method that not only makes it efficient to store that power at night, but is also very inexpensive, and they're calling it a viable alternative within 10 years.
Dan, I actually did see that article, as a matter of fact. Let me just be very clear. Above and beyond that MIT breakthrough, which may have huge potential, solar is extremely relevant today. Solar is cost-effective today. Last month, I was out in Nevada. I went to two plants, one at Nellis Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas. They have the largest photovoltaic installation in the United States. They put it up in, I think, 6 months' time. It's providing cost-effective electricity to that very large Air Force Base, about 25% of the electricity used there. And then I went out to a solar plant about 60 miles from Las Vegas. They're providing electricity now for 14,000 homes. And we know that there is in progress right now on the line developments for another 8 or 9 plants in the Southwest. And there are experts who believe that if we start work right now, if we look at this thing as an Apollo-type project where we've got to focus our energy and our resources, you could provide 15 to 20% of the electricity in this country just from solar thermal plants in the Southwest. I introduced legislation that would provide for 10 million photovoltaic solar rooftops in this country. You do that, you're also providing an enormous amount of electricity. And every day that we put up another photovoltaic unit, every day that we build another solar thermal plant, the cost of production goes down. So the MIT breakthrough may well be very, very significant in driving production costs down for electricity. But right now, we have the potential to go forward. Instead of investing in tax breaks for the oil industry, and for the very wealthiest people in this country, we should be investing big time in electricity, in wind, in geothermal, in biomass, in energy efficiency. And when we do that, we can create millions of good-paying jobs. We can deal with global warming. We could deal with environmental pollution. We can break our dependency away from Mideast and foreign oil. So this should be a very, very high priority and something that I'm going to be working and have been working very hard on.
Bravo. Roger in Santa Barbara, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I have two-part question revolving around the Tom Coburn omnibus bill. The first part of the question is, how can one senator block legislation? Just a brief summary of how that happens. And the second part of the question is, if Senator Coburn can do that, why couldn't a senator take the same approach to block a FISA bill or other bills? Or, for example, why didn't you use the same Coburn technique to stop the FISA legislation?
That's a very good question, and let me explain it as best that I can. The Senate is a very complicated institution. As many people know, for example, one of the problems that we have is that it takes 60 votes to get anything passed because what the Republicans have done in record-breaking numbers is filibuster. And that means you don't have a vote on the issue, whether it's ending the Iraq war, et cetera. What you're doing is voting to end debate. And if you can't get 60 votes to end debate, it keeps going on and on and on. Nothing gets done. The institution is bogged down. So what the leader then has to do is say, okay, we're out of that issue, we're going to another issue. The Republicans have filibustered a record-breaking, I think it's close to 90 times.
It's over 90 now.
Over 90. That's unheard of. But what Roger asked about is specifically Senator Coburn of Oklahoma. What can he do? What has he done? What you can do is to move the rules of the Senate are such that what you can do is say, okay, what normally happens is somebody gets up to the leader and says, okay, I ask unanimous consent that the bill be read and that we proceed to do this and we have these amendments or whatever. Well, if somebody says, I object to that unanimous consent, that means that the bill has got to be read in its entirety. And if it's a 1,000-page bill, you're going for I'll continue this discussion. Yeah. You could be reading the bill for 3 days.
Yeah, we'll pick up the tail end of this.
Roger asked an important question.
Yeah, we'll finish this right after the break. 45, we live and die with hard breaks on this show. 45 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, Sanders.Senate.gov, AirAmerica.com.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartmann Program.
Before the hour, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls. So, Bernie, just wrapping up how Tom Coburn has gotten away with this and why you didn't use the same technique to stop FISA.
Well, I'm picking up on Roger's question. What Coburn is opposing are many pieces of legislation, all of which are important, but they're not going to be the high-profile type pieces like FISA. If one had attempted to oppose FISA vigorously and try to stall it out, you would have had every Republican, and I think 15 or 20 Democrats in opposition. It would have passed. You probably could have delayed it for a few days.
Well, in fact, there were five efforts to essentially blow it up or change it, those five votes.
I mean, it was, so people made efforts. Did people go to do everything they could have? No. Could we have stalled it out a few more days? Yes. But the other difference is that I work, and those of us in opposition work with the majority who try to get things done. For Coburn's perspective is he really doesn't believe much in government, wants to defeat virtually everything that he can. So it's a lot easier for him to do that.
So is the distinction here that Coburn has been successful in blocking things where he knows that there's not 60 votes to overcome his objection?
It's the issues that he's blocking. I don't want to minimize the bills. I mean,
right.
Each one of them has importance, but they're not going to be as high-profile a bill. He has not, for example, he voted against the higher ed bill that we just passed last week. Why? Because we had a massive amount of support. It was a high-profile bill, and we got it through.
Right.
He would have.
So the point with regard to FISA is if you'd tried to put a hold on it or if you'd objected to it or whatever, that would have held for an hour or two until.
Maybe more than an hour or two, maybe even a few days, but it would have eventually been passed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. 866-303-2270 here, Bruce in Seattle. Hey, Bruce.
Yeah, hello.
You're on with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, I got a question for you.
Okay.
How long are these oil leases for when these oil companies get them?
That is a good question, Bruce, and I suppose they depend on the particular lease, and I don't know the answer.
Is there some reason that we can't put a thing on there that says, hey, you got a 10-year lease, you either use it or lose it?
Well, that's exactly what
that's
The answer, Bruce, is yes. So that's exactly what people are talking about right now. And legislation has been put forward in the House, and similar legislation will be put forward in the Senate. It's called use it or lose it. That's exactly right. We're giving you the opportunity to drill. If you're not going to do that, we're going to charge you for the privilege of not drilling on the land that you have already leased.
Yeah. Peter DeFazio is championing that thing in the House, and that's how it works with coal, by the way. So, you know, it's let's do it with oil. Pete in Tucson, Arizona, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. First, let me just quickly say thank you for all you both do. It's awesome.
Thank you.
I have a question, I guess, regarding the way money works in this country. And a gentleman named Mike Rupert has stated many times publicly that until you change the way money works, you change nothing. Given that the Fed is not a government agency and basically we're paying interest to private bankers, which is bankrupting this nation, the home price decline, trillions in economic losses, after the election in November, if we have a bigger Democratic majority and a President Obama, do you think it might be the time to start talking about nationalizing our currency again, printing money without debt to private bankers? That would not be inflationary because it would just be replacing lost money due to this current contraction.
Well, Pete, you raise a very fundamental and important question. I think it is important to talk about it. I do. The role of the Fed, who controls the Fed, is something that is not talked about enough. So to answer your question The answer is yes. What will happen and where we'll go remains to be seen. But there is no question that this is a hugely important issue that does not get the kind of discussion that it needs. I know when I first came into Congress back in 1991, Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas was chairman of the banking committee then, and he talked about this issue, and others talked about it before him, Wright Patman, I think. But it certainly has been an issue that has not been talked about in recent years.
This is going to be a chapter in the book I'm writing about. We need to nationalize the Fed, and you know, Canada did it briefly. They did it for a year or two, and then it got privatized again. But anyway, Dan in Missouri, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I think Barack Obama wants to. I'm sorry, thank you for taking my call. I should say.
Oh,
I think
not necessary to say.
Barack Obama is trying to have his cake and eat. He wants to keep the war going, and he wants to expand the social programs, and he wants to set up this expensive cap and trade fee system on gas, diesel, electric, and home heating. And then he says he's going to give people checks to compensate themselves for transition costs during this phase to convert over to while energy is becoming so expensive. But I think this is just a three-card Monty with our taxes. We'll have all these hidden energy taxes, but our payroll taxes won't be going up, so people won't see it as our taxes inflating at such a great rate. So I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Dan, you ask a good question, and it's going to obviously – you covered a lot of territory, and it would take more time to answer it than I have right now. But let me just deal with one part of your question. What Obama is saying, which I think makes a lot of sense, is that we need a windfall profits tax on the oil companies. Our Republican friends don't talk about the huge profits that the oil companies are making. And if you rescinded the tax breaks that the Republicans gave to the oil companies, if you imposed the windfall profits tax on them, you could, in fact, raise enough money from the oil companies to provide a rebate, a desperately needed rebate, for people in this country who are driving a lot and are paying $4 for a gallon of gas. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Would a cap and trade program bring about economic dislocation, as you suggest? The answer is yes, it would. But I think at the end of the day, because we will be moving significantly toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy, you're going to create more jobs than you lose, although you will certainly lose jobs. But the most important point, Dan, and again, this is, takes more time to discuss, is we have got to address the crisis of global warming. I know that some people don't believe that, but I do. The scientific community is virtually unanimous in saying the situation is worse than they had previously thought. It is getting the projections into the future are really scary, and we have got to deal with that in one way or another, and I think Obama is right in attempting to do that.
And I agree. Not that I need to, but Senator Sanders, Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And all these years that you've been on this program.
Okay.
Sanders.Senate.gov. Get over there, check out Bernie's website. Coming up next, Ron Suskind is going to tell us all about what's going on in Washington, D.C.
This is Tom Hartman. Is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. John McCain getting his facts wrong. It's just Fox News displaying the Iranian flag during a report on Iraq. It's amazing now, all the bizarre news that's out there. Dick Cheney is going to participate, by the way, in the RNC convention. The Republicans are unabashedly embracing him and Bush, of course. But I think the thing that concerns me the most is this, and I mentioned it in my conversation with Bernie, this article that Robert Perry wrote called Why McCain May Well Win. The very real possibility that John McCain could win the presidency, not because his policies are better, not because he's a better candidate even, Not because he's telling the truth or not, but because the corporate media in the United States feels no obligation whatsoever to either A, tell the truth, or B, present news that they're all about making money. And in the context, which, you know, in and of itself, you'd say for a for-profit corporation, great, make money. But within certain boundaries, if you are the media, and particularly if you are a media monopoly, if you are a media that has control of a vehicle of the media that has a very limited number of outlets, for example, cable, radio, or television, then it's entirely appropriate to say, yes, you can make money, and you have to serve the public with this, with your use of the public good. And you could even say this is true of newspapers, to the extent that newspapers have been subsidized in the United States since the creation of this nation. For the first 100 years of our nation, we subsidized the manufacture of newsprint to make it cheaper for newspapers. I mean, that literally started with the George Washington administration and ran through the Civil War. We subsidized the production of newsprint to make it cheaper for newspapers so that there could be more newspapers. And for literally from the George Washington administration till today, we subsidized the mailing of newspapers. Newspapers have what's called a special fourth class rate, and that you can mail a newspaper for very, very little. It's the post office actually delivers newspapers at a loss. Why? Because the founders viewed news as part of the commons. And this is why also we passed legislation that said newspapers or that radio stations, television stations, cable companies have to provide some public service. In the case of the cable companies, all the cable companies have to kick in a little bit of their profits to pay for C-SPAN. C-SPAN is their way of giving back and also local cable access. But radio and television stations, between Reagan blowing up the Fairness Doctrine in 87 and Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act in 96, radio and television stations no longer have an obligation to provide the truth or the news. And in fact, this was even litigated down in Florida, where a Fox-owned TV station had told two of their reporters, and you can just Google Fox RGBH suit, it's quite easy to find. They had told two of their reporters that they had to, these guys had written a story, Jane and Steve, had written a story about how Monsanto's recombinant bovine growth hormone was, you know, showing up in milk all over the place. And I'm trying to track this thing down as I'm talking because it's here we go. It was in 1998. And so anyhow, they did this story and they submitted the story about how this hormone was showing up. It was being given to all these cattle and things. And the Fox station said, and the news director said to these two reporters, that you have to change this story. Jane Aker and Steve Wilson, you must change this story. And they said, okay, we'll change it slightly. And they did this a number of times. They changed it like 10, 15, 20 times, you know, each time just taking out things that seemed kind of nasty to Monsanto. Eventually, the Fox station was telling them, you've got to change it in a way that is not, it's no longer even truthful. It's not just selectively distorted. It's actually factually not truthful. You have to lie. And Jane Aker and Steve Wilson said, no, we won't do that. And they were fired by the TV station. They sued for wrongful termination. And a jury of their peers, a jury of six of their peers, awarded them $425,000. Said absolutely, you shouldn't. A television station should not have the right to fire people for refusing to tell lies on the air. Unanimous verdict. So Fox appealed this to an appeals court with all these wonderful right-wing judges on them. After a five-week trial, the appeals court found there was nothing wrong with telling reporters that they have to lie. Right. I mean, in fact, here, this is a story from the Dateline Tampa. You can find it over at organicconsumers.org. The Fox appeal was largely on an argument that it is not technically illegal for a broadcaster to deliberately distort the news on television. And the appeals court said, yep, that's the case. So here we have a media that no longer has to even tell the truth, much less has to perform a public service, and regularly doesn't tell the truth. And Robert Perry talking about how, you know, this could, you know, John McCain is getting a free pass constantly on this stuff. Because they have bought into, the media has bought into this line that he's the straight talk guy and that Obama is the flip-flopper. And as a consequence of that, the real issues are not being discussed. And I think this is just an absolute tragedy. And it highlights the disaster that we have with our media that the Republicans are very happy to have. This is something, you know, Republicans represent a very small minority in America. The couple hundred thousand families who make more than $1 million a year, there's only a couple hundred, maybe not even that. I've seen different numbers over the years of that run from as low as 20,000 to as high as 300,000 families who earn, you know, more than $5 million a year, more than $2 million a year, depending on where your thresholds are. But it's a relatively small number of people. That is the Republican constituency by and large, and the corporations associated with them. And it just is not a good thing for American democracy, frankly, in my opinion, that we don't have the ability any longer to say, if you're going to use the public airwaves, you must program in the public interest. I'm not talking about, you know, for every hour of the Tom Hartman program, there has to be an hour of the Rush Limbaugh program or vice versa. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm doing just fine, thank you very much. You know, we beat Bill O'Reilly almost 2-1 in Los Angeles in the last book. We beat Rush Limbaugh again in the last book. You know, this show is doing very, very well. And as a progressive show, has more listeners than any other show out there, period. But that's sort of like saying, you know, I'm the biggest goldfish in a small goldfish bowl. I mean, you know, come on. What we've got to do is say, you know, we need to be talking about the ocean. You know, Limbaugh's on 600 stations. But I digress. The larger point is that the networks, the radio and television networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, that provide programming to radio and television stations, used to lose money in their news operations because their news operations had as their primary job to fulfill the requirement of their local affiliates that they provide community information, that they provide a service to their community. And the form of that service was a good, solid, real, live newscast. And that has gone by the wayside. Between Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, that's dead. And if we're not going to be providing people with accurate, true information, and even NPR is no longer doing this, by the way, in my humble opinion. It's become National Republican Radio. You get the business news every day. When was the last time you heard a half hour or hour dedicated to labor news? Oh, we've got the market reports. Well, what about the state of the workplace reports? We don't want to talk about that. We can't find corporate sponsors for that, you see. So I think that we have to seriously look at the state of news in the United States, and that the actual reality of the state of news in the United States could lead to a McCain victory if we don't start speaking out and speaking loudly and holding these folks accountable and pushing back on the stories that are out there. We'll take your calls. Anything Goes Friday right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
Heaven knows anything goes. God is touching, it's the bell. Buzz Heskind will be with us at the top of the next hour. Right now, Anything Goes Friday, 21 minutes past the hour, here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And Tom in Dallas, Texas, listening on KOKE. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Well, I heard you with the senator, and I couldn't get in. I have a lot of questions, but I heard about you advertising your book. What do you call middle America? What's the average wage of the middle American person?
Well, the median income in the United States right now is between $41,000 and $45,000. Usually around $44,200, I think, is the number that's used. But I would say, you know, for the purposes of my definition in my book, Screwed, what I'm talking about are people who do not have independent means. Basically, people who if they were to lose their income for a year or 2 years would be totally, or even a few weeks, would be totally screwed. And I would say that runs from the bottom of the pay scale probably up to people making $100,000, $150,000 a year, maybe even $200,000 a year if they're living in a very expensive area where housing is very expensive.
Okay, well, the people over $100,000 have some choices to cut things out to not live that expensive lifestyle. You know, people at $50,000.
Broadly, I don't disagree with you. But my point is that there is an entire another world in America that most Americans have never had contact with and don't even understand exists. That there is a group of Americans who don't fly on commercial airplanes. They fly on private jets. They live in gated communities. They have drivers who take them everywhere. I mean, they don't even drive cars. I remember some 20, 30 years ago, I was buying my first, it was more than 30 years ago, my first really fancy, expensive suit. I went to Saks Fifth Avenue in New York to do it right? And because I owned this company, we were doing pretty well, and I thought, you know, okay. And the guy said, you want to have a shirt without a pocket. You know, and I said, why would I want to have a shirt without a pocket? Because he was saying, you know, you got to have this and you got to have that. And he said, because, you know, truly rich people don't carry things in their pockets. They have people who carry their things. And it's a status symbol to have a shirt without a pocket. And I thought, this is just the weirdest thing I've ever heard. But I'm telling you, when Poppy Bush looked at a scanner in a supermarket and said, holy cow, what's this new invention, you know, back in, you know, 20 years ago, it showed how out of touch he was, because he's always, his whole life, had people who carry his money. The same thing for George W. There is a group of people that essentially are the landed gentry that did not exist during the founding era. We didn't have this kind of wealth in the United States from the founding of the United States up until after the Civil War, up until the rise of the railroad barons. And we have had it now since the 1870s, 1880s, and the robber barons, and they're with us, and they have basically taken over control in most parts of this country, and I think that the founding fathers would roll over in their graves. I was last night reading.
Okay, wait a minute.
Yeah, go ahead. Your point, sure.
You don't think the Kennedys and the robber barons can keep?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And the difference, okay. the difference between Jack and Bobby Kennedy and George W. Bush is that Jack and Bobby Kennedy were taught by their mother, by and large, Rose Kennedy, that because they were wealthy, they had what the British refer to as noblesse oblige, the obligation of nobility. You must give back because you've been given so much. And so they dedicated themselves to public service. They dedicated their lives to things that they didn't really have to do. George Bush never got that. George Bush was all me, in my
opinion. Kennedy up there right now, you know, and there's a lot of politicians up there that have, you know, they're politicians. They have no clue what it is. They're making $150,000 a year, and they're in the upper 10%, and they have no clue what it is for the average guy to make money to do this anymore. The other thing is,
especially in the Senate,
the majority
of senators are multimillionaires.
Right, and they have no clue what it is because they've been in the trough for so long that they have no what it is. You can't get rid of them until they die, and even then, I wonder if.
Well, but see, then the flip side of that, Tom, is like, you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is an average middle class guy with an average middle class house, and he has literally lived on his House and Senate salary all these years, and living both in Washington D.C. and in Vermont. That doesn't leave a whole lot of room and money. Bernie is just, you know, he's getting by. Because he's not cutting deals on the side like some of these other guys.
Okay, before you cut me off, here's the way to do it. We buy 535 apartments and they live in an apartment, a three-bedroom apartment, for the common guy can go back to Washington and stay in Washington. And we heat the place, and we keep it cool, and we keep it up, then the common guy. Now, the second thing is, and nobody's been able to answer this question. I've asked this on other radio stations. I want to know what the average bureaucratic person makes per hour, per year, and I want to know what the average American worker makes per year.
Well, I can tell you right now, this is the sea change, Tom. In the 1950s, government employees made on average less than industrial workers in the United States. So the average unionized industrial worker in the United States made more than the average government employee. Right now, the average government employee makes more than the average industrial worker. Now,
how much more?
If I had to guess, I'd say probably 20 to 40%. It's significant.
Okay.
And the reason why is not because government salaries have gone up. The reason why is because corporate America has cut the salaries on everybody else who's working out there, and the government employees, because they have
a
strong union.
But we need to cut the government salaries.
You're saying it's a race to the bottom. You're saying because America, because the corporations in America are screwing the guys at GM.
Everybody else in America is cutting salaries, and we need to get the government to cut salaries, too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's all become Walmart workers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
It came along. Everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, "You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything."
34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. You can find out more at teamster.org. And my apologies to one of our newest affiliates, KMMY, Rational Radio, 50,000 watts in Dallas, Texas, where this show is broadcast live every day on AM 1360. I had your call letter wrong with that last caller from Dallas. It's KMMY, Rational Radio 1360. Monday, June 25th, 1787. This is at the Constitutional Convention. Mr. Pinckney is speaking. These are the notes that James Madison took. And they're talking about how should they compensate members of the House and Senate. What kind of payment should be made to them? And the discussion is, we don't want to create an aristocracy in America. There isn't an aristocracy in America. All the truly rich people left during and after the Revolutionary War, because they were all, you know, the aristocracy of Britain. And Mr. Pinckney speaks on June 25th, 1787. He says, "The people of the United States are perhaps the most singular of any we are acquainted with. Among them, there are few distinctions of fortune and less of rank than among the inhabitants of any other nation. Every free man has the right to the same protection and security, and a very moderate share of property entitles them to the possession of all the honors and privileges the public can bestow. Hence arises a greater equality than is found among the people of any other country, and an equality which is likely to continue. I say this equality is likely to continue because in a new country possessing immense tracts of uncultivated lands, where every temptation is offered to emigration, where industry must be rewarded with competency, there are very few poor and few dependent. Every member of society," and he goes on and on about this, and you know, basically, because what they're saying is that if we're going to pay Congress, it should be basically a kind of middle-class salary. He goes on, he says, if equality, as I contend, is the leading feature of the United States, where then are the riches and wealth whose representation and protection is the particular province of a permanent body? In other words, you know, where it, usually senates are to defend the rich. Where are they? He says, are they in the hands of a few who may be called rich, in the possession of less than 100 citizens? Certainly not in this United States. They are in the great body of the people, among whom there are no men of wealth and very few of real poverty now in the United States. It is it probable that a change will be created and that a new order of men will arise? If under the British government for a century no such change was probable, I think it can be fairly concluded that it will not take place while even the semblance of republicanism remains. In other words, the modern democratic institutions. The founders were very clear. They did not want an aristocracy. They also didn't want a race to the bottom, which is what our last caller was advocating. Gee, you know, the guys with unions, with good union jobs, by and large, have been able to hold on to their pay, whether they're government workers or whether they're General Motors workers or whatever. They've been able to hold on to their pay. But what's happened is that the largest employer in the United States is no longer General Motors. It's now Walmart, which is not unionized and which pays poorly. I tell a story about the Louise and I were walking over to the store here last summer, and there was a guy in the local neighborhood, Selwood. They want to keep out of Walmart, and so, you know, there's all these houses with signs out in front to say no Walmart in Selwood. And there was a guy standing on the street, and he said Selwood loves Walmart, or words to that effect. And so I walked up to him and I said, "How much is Walmart paying you to stand here holding that sign?" And he says, $15 an hour," you know, which is more than they pay. So. Anyways, the fact that, you know, we're being Walmartized, the income of Americans is being destroyed, is no reason to say, okay, yeah, let's do it to the very last. You know, no, let's raise the bar. By the way, I mentioned Jane Aker and Steve White, who sued Fox, this Fox RGBH suit, and you can find the actual audio of this. I interviewed Jane on August 21st in 2003. That's what, almost exactly 5 years ago this week. And this is just a little piece from that. I'm wondering, is your sense that this is just one little isolated thing, or is this indicative of an entire trend? Is this something that is just, this is the way they do business?
Well, I think it's the way Fox does business. We, in preparing our lawsuit, had talked to another reporter who did a story somewhere in the Midwest on one of the Dow chemical products, and his managers handed the story to Dow to do the editing before it went on the air, which, you know, he couldn't believe it. He quit. He just had never had that experience happen in his life.
So are the people who think that Fox is like the last unbiased news source out there actually true and fair, and are they suckers?
I think people believe what they want to believe. If Fox leans in a certain direction that they like, if they like rude anchors who interrupt people and don't let them talk, if they like to see a presentation that only puts one side of the story out or a very limited scope, then that's for them. They should treat themselves to some other voices. After all, that's what democracy is about. That's what a healthy media should be about as well.
What can people do to help you out?
Well, we're sort of in the final stages of our appeal. If people would like to contribute, our lawyers would certainly appreciate that. None of the money goes to us. I think, really, you know, look at our website, get involved. Media reform is a huge issue right now that will affect every single one of us if the further consolidation is allowed. Go to www.mediareform.net and please put your voice in to your representatives that you do not want the further consolidation of media.
That's mediareform.net. And Jane and Steve's website is foxbghsuit.com. So anyway, those things to wrap up our conversation in the previous little bit of this hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rob in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today? Rob?
Hello?
Hey, you're on
the
air.
Tell me I can't stay on hold anymore?
Sorry.
Come on, Tom. You know, I mean, the whole thing is you speak for the common man, and I have no way to be able to listen to you except on the phone.
Oh, no. Okay.
Thanks, Tom, for speaking for the common man. The whole thing is where I want to be able to pass one idea by you. Is America polarized by ideologies?
Right. Yeah, I think we are. I mean, you know, this so-called conservative ideology that we're all, you know, you're on your own, Charlie, you know, works out very well if you've got $5 million in the bank or $50 million in the bank, but it doesn't work out very well if you're screwed if you lose your paycheck.
Yeah, but the whole thing is now I got to be able to ask you one last question before you're going to cut me off. It's where the average American pay, as far as in America, if you took away the top 5% and eliminated the bottom 5%, wouldn't the pay average move down a whole lot more?
No, actually, it'd move up quite a bit.
It would move down. It would move up because, I mean, the whole thing is I mean, when they're at the top 5% is moving up and making all of the money, and the bottom 5% isn't making hardly any money, that right. average would move down.
No, it actually wouldn't, because the top 5% holds so much money. I mean, Bill Gates himself alone, one guy, has more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans.
You don't quite understand my premise.
Okay. Then say it to me again.
Total American economy.
Right.
As far as how much money is made.
Right.
And you divide it by all of the workers, including Bill Gates.
Right.
Or Richard Buffett or whoever his name is.
Yeah.
And all these people that are making the mega dollars. Wouldn't the average American income go down?
If you're only, you know, this is one of those areas where you can play with the numbers however you want. If you're talking about wages, probably yes.
Average income per year.
Yeah, exactly. If you're talking about wages, because Bill Gates doesn't make most of his money in wages, and neither does Warren Buffett. In fact, the vast majority of very wealthy people don't make their money in wages. They make their money in dividends.
That's not included in the income as far
no.
as average American income?
No. When conservatives quote those numbers about, you know, oh, the rich, this percentage of the rich are paying this percentage of the income tax, this percent, or they use the word wages.
They pay 40% of the taxes, make 20% of the income, but the whole thing is they're still far ahead.
Right, exactly. When you're talking about wages, you're talking about money that is in the United
off
States.
The
a corporation can only deduct the from their income taxes wages up to $1 million a year.
It's almost off the books, isn't it?
No, well, the way it gets off the books is instead of giving compensating an executive, say they want to give an executive $20 million, they'll give them $1 million in wages and they'll give them $19 million worth of stock. The executive then sells that stock, and that $19 million sale of the stock is dividend is a capital gain, which is a maximum 15% income tax, A, and B is not considered wages. So if you add up the wages of the wealthiest versus the wages of the poorest, and you try to, you know, even it all out, yeah, it may actually slide things down. If you add up the total income of the wealthiest versus the poor. I mean, there's no contest. It's absolutely no contest.
I know that, you know what I mean? But that's just it. It's where, you know I mean? You know, like he talked about, the inflation rate is higher than it is. The unemployment rate is higher than it is. You know what I mean? Right now they're talking about the average income of America. Isn't that almost higher than it is?
Well, it depends on how you define it.
Well, this works the formula.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, and that's where what you'll find is that, you know, by and large, you'll find conservatives only talking about income tax and only talking about wages because they don't want to talk about the fact that working people saw under, for example, Ronald Reagan, saw their FICA taxes, saw their payroll taxes on the first, you know, what back then was $30,000 or something like that, double. And or nearly double, and the biggest tax increase in American history. You know, somehow we forget that because it didn't hit the rich.
Thanks, Tom. So. You know, the whole thing is I'm almost selling my only fine book, and it's great.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rob. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, or AirAmerica.com.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Yesterday we had Phil Lindsay on, the chairman of Show Me the Vote, who got arrested for trying to vote in eastern Jackson County, Missouri. And he mentioned Charlene Davis, the head of the election board there, if I have her title right. And I thought, gee, let's get Charlene Davis on and see what her side of the story is. So she's with us. Charlene Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are if the story is that I have is correct, you're a political appointee, a Republican and head of the Eastern Jackson County, Missouri Election Board. Do I have that right?
That's correct, and I've been here for 34 years.
Great. Hey, and 34 years on an election board, I want to salute you, first of all. I've been trying to encourage as many of my listeners as possible to sign up to volunteer to be poll workers.
Oh, you're wonderful.
And we need, I mean, this is something we really need. So, you know, Phil was legally and correctly trying to vote with ID that was acceptable in the state of Missouri.
Correct. Incorrect.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Lindsay wasn't there to vote. Mr. Lindsay admitted to us that he was there to test the system. And he has done that on numerous previous elections.
Mm-hmm.
He has walked into a poll. Missouri is a closed or an open primary state, meaning you don't register by party. You declare your political party when you vote.
Right.
And he has walked in and said, I want a Republican ballot, and then said, ha, 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 I beat you. I voted Democrat, and you better not count my ballot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so he was definitely in there to cause a disturbance. And I'll tell you what, in defense of our little election judges who are all over the age of 65, they have a long day. They have a 14-hour day, and they try very hard to do the right thing. And Mr. Lindsay walked in with what was called a poll notification card that does not have the legal address of the voter, and it is not considered a government document.
Right.
And he walked in there and showed that to him, and they told him that that was not a document. And so then he pulled out his bank statement out of his back pocket, as did his son.
Right.
And, you know,
and I'm looking at the Secretary of State's page here, and it says that those two things together are just as good as a driver's license, that constitutes legal ID to vote.
There's no poll notification on that. There's a voter identification, and if he had showed that, it would have been accepted. But the judges aren't used to seeing a bank statement in somebody's pocket, and they didn't know. So they called the election board, which is exactly what they were told to do. If you're not sure, call. They did, and they were told that was acceptable. The bank statement was. But he was so out of control, and at that point in time, that he was screaming at them, yelling at them, pointing his fingers, stomping on the desk, and they were scared to death he was going to pull a gun.
Charlene, don't we want people to be testing the system? Don't we want to know that all of us can vote?
No, it should be a very orderly process, and nobody in this jurisdiction is denied the right to vote if they're a registered voter. People were scared, so they called the police. I dispatched two people from this office who got there, and the older gentleman was still screaming. They threw him in the paddy wagon for being disorderly. And we talked to the son on the phone. They threatened to throw him in there, and we talked to him. We told him to go outside. We'll talk to him on the parking lot. We said, come up here and we'll talk to you, which he did after about 3 hours.
Okay, Charlene, if we're talking with Charlene Davis, the head of the East Jackson County, Missouri Election Board, if somebody shows up with that yellow card that you can see on the Secretary of State's...
No, it's not yellow here. It's a gray card.
Or it's a gray card, okay.
Uh-huh.
It showed up yellow on the Secretary of State's webpage.
Well, it may be that's a generic card.
I see, okay.
Okay.
And a bank statement. You will let them vote, right?
Oh, my goodness, yes. They don't even need that card. All they need is a bank statement. They need a school ID. They can use an employee card.
So when this guy pulled out a bank statement, why didn't they simply say, go ahead and vote?
They didn't remember. There's like 40 IDs that are listed on the charts we gave them and on the wall.
Right, but he said, here's the paper from the Secretary of State's office that says it's legal. Why didn't they just look at that and say, fine, you know, so you got a bad attitude. Go ahead and vote anyway.
They were scared to death. That's why they called. That's what we told them to do. Call if you're not sure. And they did.
Here's the concern, Charlene, that many of us have. In May of 1980, Paul Weyrich, speaking before a group of Republicans in a church, Paul Weyrich, the guy who was the main architect, he's sort of the Karl Rove of the Reagan campaign, and he's still advising President Bush, made this comment.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that has been, I mean, you know, this is
that's
what,
not the attitude of this office. That is not the attitude at all. We want everybody to vote. That's why we said call. If you're not sure, call. And they did. They did exactly what they were told and trained to do. And we gave them permission. But Mr. Lindsay wasn't even listening. He was just screaming and pointing. And they were scared. You'd be scared, too, if somebody came on your show and got right in your face and started screaming at you.
Yeah, I may be.
I mean, you know, we're talking about
laugh at them. I don't
an
know.
80-year-old, a 75-year-old, a 68-year-old, and a 65-year-old. They were scared.
But I mean, do you understand, Charlene Davis, do you understand that there is a concern after Catherine Harris, you know, knocking 90,000 people off the ballots in Florida, we see these
changing
efforts.
That doesn't happen here.
That's not going to happen in Missouri.
No, it has not happened here. We are very careful.
Okay, good. And
we have the lowest
and Let's agree. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but it's just the clock. I'm not trying to cut you off, but you know let's agree between the two of us that we want as many people as possible to volunteer to be poll workers. Can
oh,
we leave
yeah,
it at
wonderful.
That? Okay, Charlene Davis, thanks a lot. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Ron Suskind is on the line with us, the author, journalist, documentarian, Pulitzer Prize winner. Ron Suskind, SUSKIND.com, his website, his new book, The Way of the World, The Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. Ron, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Nice to be
you. You, in your new book, there are two issues here that I really wanted to get into with you on this. The first has to do with this forged document, and everybody's been talking about this in the press. I'm guessing most of our listeners already have some familiarity with it, that George Tenet came back from a meeting at the White House with this cream-colored piece of paper and gave it to some folks at the CIA and said, we're going to forge a document. This is now after Joe Wilson has basically outed the lies of the Bush administration. We're going to forge a document that appears to be from Mr. Habush, the head of intelligence, their equivalent of the CIA director in Iraq, saying that, yes, in fact, Saddam Hussein had these weapons of mass destruction. Do I have that right?
You got it pretty much on the money.
Okay.
It says that, in fact, it's quite a letter. It says that that Mohammed Atta trained in Iraq prior to 9/11, establishing that Saddam al-Qaeda link, and also that Saddam's out buying yellow cake uranium with al-Qaeda's help. It was quite a creative feat, a document of fantastical kind of energy. So yes, that would be a crime, because the CIA, by statute and amendment, is not permitted to run disinformation campaigns on the United States. It's quite a serious thing. And today, in fact, we have posted on my website, on ronsuskind.com, just my name, ronsuskind.com, we have posted the transcripts of my interview in June. There are many interviews through the spring with Rob Richer, the head of the Mideast Operations, Near East Division, so-called, for the CIA, who was the key player, and he recalls with great vividness in this interview his connection conversations with George Tenet when George came back from the White House with the mission on the Bush letter. Rob describes the stationery, how they felt, what George said, it being passed down the ranks for execution. There it is, and Richard's on the record, and it's rather complete and irrefutable.
Now, that being a crime, that could lead to prosecution that could go all the way up to the president or vice president, I would assume. But
yes,
the American conservative,
yes, good.
I'm sorry.
That's good, yeah, you're right.
The American conservative Philip Giraldi is asserting that, in fact, you've got it right, but not quite. That actually it wasn't the CIA that forged the letter, although it might have been handed through people like George Tenet and folks at the CIA. But the actual forgery was done by Doug Feith's group, the Office of Special Plans, which is part of the Pentagon, and whose charter does not make this a crime.
You know, I think that the fact is that the book shows with clarity exactly what people absolutely positively recall. If Feith or DOD was involved in, frankly, it's hard to separate DOD from the White House in this period, to be blunt, but if they were involved in some sort of mission, along with the White House, it's clear that Tenet comes back from the White House and is carrying this assignment on White House stationery, and frankly, when it comes to ordering the CIA to do something of this fashion, you pretty much get those orders from the White House. DOD and CIA don't get along very well. And if it was, channeled the way all the sources involved say, from the White House through Tenet to CIA, there are only a few people at the very top of the White House, duly elected types generally, who can give that kind of order.
We're talking Dick Cheney and George W. Bush.
Well, that would be the stuff beyond what a journalist can do.
Yeah, and this is now so clearly we need congressional hearings, a special prosecutor, those kinds of things to find out.
There's an extraordinary effusion of on the record comments in this book. It's part of the, I think, an emblem of the end of this Bush era. This
right.
sort of clamp down, sort of culture of fear and often silence, message discipline, has really dissolved. And as it's dissolved, I've been sort of collecting quickly over the last year, pretty much the whole array of what really went on and what it means for the future. Not only what it means for today, in terms of the key issue, but the big sweeping issue, which is how does America repair and revive its moral authority in the world? I mean,
right. There
is no real power without moral authority. Now we recognize that, now that it's bled away, and how, when you've got so much assembled might and conflicting powerful interests in one place as America, how do you manage to go about the difficult, often humbling process of going into the valley and coming to sunlight and restoring moral energy? That's the big challenge for America in this period and certainly in this election.
This is the Gulf of Tonkin on steroids.
I think so.
Do you have any evidence, or do your sources point you in the direction of it being either the vice president or the president or both who issued the order that this illegal forgery be done?
Well, it's interesting because in the transcript that you can read online today on ronsuspan.com, you can just go right through it. I have a long discussion with Richard where I'm really pressing Rob. He's a good guy, and he's under a lot of pressure right now, and I'm sympathetic to him being in a real pickle. He's a contractor, runs a consulting firm, does intelligence contracting, he's under the kind of weight of the damned right now. And what it has there is Richard and I talking a lot, trying to focus on that very question. He thinks it's a vice president's office, but what do you know? Absolutely, certainly. And even though he says I essentially bet my career on the fact it came from Libby and the gang at the vice president's office, he says, what I absolutely know, it came from the White House, which would
right.
be the president's office, the vice president, and
yeah.
possibly the NSC, those things housed in the White Building.
Right. So we need a serious investigation. Does this mean that Vince Bugliosi, the former prosecutor of Charlie
right.
Manson,
wanting to charge him for murder, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's suggesting that all of the U.S. soldiers who died in Iraq should be considered murder victims, and that George Bush should be considered the murderer because there was a criminal conspiracy that led to their death, and that's one of the definitions of murder. Would you agree with that argument if it is in fact what you're asserting is demonstrated to be true in a court of law?
Well, I come from, I guess, a more traditional school of reportage. You know, I have lots of sources. We meet hour after hour, day after day. They tell me everything they know. I make sense of it. I put it together. I'm not an advocate. You know, I don't assert an assault.
Right.
Look, I understand why people are angry. That I do understand. You know, the fact is that based on our meetings with the Iraq intelligence chief in January, early January of 2003, three weeks before the President's State of the Union address, a month before Colin Powell goes before the UN, this guy is starting to meet with us in the secret location, tell us everything we learn later. I mean, that is startling. And the fact is, there's a lot of pushback, and that wasn't the reality at the time, and there was assumptions there were WMD, so we thought he was lying. All of that is really a missed step analysis. The fact of the matter is, if the President of the United States, when he first hears about it, it's interesting, George Bush, when he hears about the Iraq intelligence chief and what he's saying, no WMD, he says, you know, wasn't he, give us something we can use for our case? That's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, said of this other stuff.
Yeah. Now,
you know, if the President though, had stood up and said for the 16 words, you know, we have recently discovered that there may not be any WMD in Iraq, that would have been a huge change for American history.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Ron Suskind, his new book, The Way of the World, The Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. His website, ronsuskind.com. Ron, the Jack of Diamonds, Mr. Habush, he is still missing. I understand from your book that we actually met with him before the war, before the invasion, paid him $5 million, put him into hiding, and we're going to have to take a break in about a minute. Can you stick around over the break and we can continue this conversation until the bottom of the hour? Do you have that time? Hello? Ah, okay. We're gonna take a break right this second, and because his phone apparently just dropped out, and we'll see if we can pick up Ron Suskind on the other end. I want to have this conversation about the Jack of Diamonds. If not, I'll tell you what I know about it from what I've seen of the transcripts of his books. And then we'll be taking your calls as well on Anything Goes Friday here. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program right here on Air America with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. You're nearly there, therefore. Ron Suskind back with us. Ron, for a minute there, I thought Dick Cheney had dropped by to invite you to go hunting with him.
Target practice, baby.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for sticking around with us a little bit.
Sure. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. And the Jack of Diamonds. By the way, I just went over to ronsuskind.com, your book, The Way of the World. It's brilliant. I read the transcript with Rob Richer. And I thought it was fascinating that he says, we're actually not trying to influence Americans, we're trying to influence Iraqis.
I know.
It's like, you know, this is your get out of jail free card, right?
You know, it's nice. I haven't talked to many people who've read it, and of course that's a real, you can't be serious. And we have another character in the book, John McGuire, who's head of Iraq operations for CIA, an amazing guy, really, a real kind of hero character, who answers that question. Says that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Because McGuire spent 13 years in Iraq. He's a real pro. He's like, the Iraqis had no care at all for WMD. This was simply to solve a political problem in the White House.
Right.
In America, period.
Yeah. And this was again, after Joe Wilson, after the invasion, after the insurgency had already begun, and Joe Wilson had outed everybody. But back, if we go back before the invasion even started, we were able to, our intelligence service was able to get the head of Iraqi intelligence, Mr. Habush, their George Tenet, their head of their CIA.
That's right.
Able to get him to become a double agent for us, essentially, and tell us everything he knew about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, which was that it didn't exist.
Yeah, that's right.
We paid him $5 million. We hid him away.
That's right.
Where is he now?
He's in Amman, Jordan. And when last I tried to get in touch with him at the end of the project through some intermediaries, and it just was a little too touchy, a little too problematic. But, yeah, he was in when last noted by...
But he's still, there's $1 million reward for this guy. I mean, they want
It's sort of above the table, under the table situation where the United States publicly says he's one of their most wanted men, you know, a war criminal. There's $1 million bounty on his head. State Department says he's a man we are seeking. Meanwhile, of course, he's sitting in a carefully constructed little... doctor, the safe house, I guess, in Amman, Jordan, with $5 million from the United States Treasury. But interestingly, we don't end up using them for anything, which I think further affirms the idea that it was simply hush money. You know, one of the, this guy McGuire, again, the CIA Iraq chief, says we are all terrified during that summer that Habush would pop up on the screen, the summer of 2003 when it became clear there were no weapons to the whole world. And that's when they nailed down his deal as to the size of his compensation.
Yeah. So,
what a world.
Yeah. So Mr. Habush is still, and ironically, it was over his name that they forged this letter, you know, a year and a half later.
That's right. At the end of December 2003, at that point, it all was blossoming, the disaster. And the charge, which of course is on this day, and publication of this book really takes up its fullness, is that the United States went to war under false pretenses, an enormous historical crime. I mean, I'll tell you, in a study history, even dictators thought hard about the just cause for war.
Oh, sure. You know, Hitler was trying to justify Poland.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, ultimately, young people are going to be dying, and if you don't tell them why they're going to die very specifically and clearly, even if you're a king or a dictator, they're going to turn on you, and that'll be that, much less a duly elected leader. And that lack of faith in basic American, even human principles to say, you know, it's just the case. It's like something out of the ad department. It's something that obviously makes Americans angry, much less families of the 4,000 young men and women who perished there, 19,000 folks maimed in Iraq, the enormous hundreds of billions spent, and America's moral authority bled away. Because as the book points out, is that the real challenge of this period is one of the kind of, you know, sort of dark side flips of the modern age, the miracle of the information age, which of course is bringing the world up by the hour, means that as well, though, the dark cousin at this party is that small groups of individuals can carry now the destructive power once reserved for nations. It's an amazing change. In a borderless world, this presents an extraordinary dilemma to humanity. But, and right now the United States desperately needs moral authority to lead that struggle, and they don't have it.
You know, Mickey Herskowitz, who was the a Bush family friend, he's a journalist down in Texas.
Yeah.
He wrote the first draft of A Charge to Keep, George Bush's autobiography, on the record, has said that in 1999, this is before George Bush was even running for president,
yeah.
In 1999, George Bush told him that if he became president, the first thing he'd do is attack Saddam Hussein because it would give him political capital to do things like rolling back Social Security.
That's interesting. You know, of course, I'm the author of a book called The Price of Loyalty, which, you know, I'm a kindred of your man in Texas, because that showed definitively, using internal White House documents, testimony from senior officials, principals of the National Security Council, that from the first National Security Council meeting of this presidency, January 2001, it was all about getting Saddam Hussein. How do we, not a matter of if, it's a matter of how and how quickly, and the case for war was discussed even in that first meeting. Can it unfold a map of a factory? They say it's chemical weapons, biological weapons. How do we justify it? Because we're going to do it anyhow.
Right. Ed Bush, 2 years earlier, had told Mickey Herskowitz he was going to do this to gain power for the Republican Party. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Well, you can read all about it by buying The Way of the World, The Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, Ron Suskind, or go to ronsuskind.com for that and all these new transcripts.
Read that
amazing.
Transcript.
Ron, thanks so much for dropping by.
Please.
Keep up the great
work,
sir. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
We're paying for this White House. I mean, you know, these are all elected officials. Come on. The other revelation in Ron Suskind's book that we didn't have a chance to talk with him about is that the White House now has its own interrogation room. Yep. Turns out a large uniformed man lunges at this guy who is this Italian tourist, excuse me, Pakistani U.S. college graduate. And he's fiddling with his iPod. So they lunge at him and drag him into the White House interrogation room. Cement wall box with a table, two chairs, a hanging light and a bare bulb, and a mounted video camera. Right there in the basement of the White House. Yes, dark, dank, and horrific. The guy, by the way, is a graduate of Connecticut College. He works for the International Monetary Fund. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. And the quote, by the way, that I was sharing with Ron Suskind, this is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission, and she has the exact language, so I'll just let Cindy say it.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. Thus, 4,000 Americans dead, as many as a million Iraqis dead, 4.5 million people displaced, the moral authority of the United States all over the world destroyed. Why? So George Bush can privatize Social Security. So the Republicans can hold a majority in the House and Senate. 1-866-303-2270, Streamer in Worcester, Mass. Hey, Streamer, thanks for sitting on line.
Oh,
so long.
Hi, Tom. Listen, morphed a little bit since I first was calling because it's a pet peeve of mine, the media spin and how to crack through it.
Yeah.
Listening to your story about the Fox case.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, you know, like that codifies that it's okay to lie in news, but also, that the liars are so organized.
Yeah. Actually, you're absolutely right. And they organize around these right-wing websites and these right-wing think tanks. And it is really and truly astounding. Streamer, excellent point, and thank you for making it. I appreciate the call. Harvey in Berkeley, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Harvey.
Hi, Tom. Well, I think I found out who's holding Rush Limbaugh's leash.
Who's that?
It's the military-industrial complex. And let me explain it to you.
Okay.
Well, I started noting that I started noticing that local ABC radio stations are starting to talk about nuclear energy, and I tried to get on some of the talk shows there, and I wouldn't get on about solar energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up, I heard they were sold, and turns out they were sold to a company called Citadel Broadcasting, if everybody wants to write that down, Citadel, Citadel, C-I-T-E-D-E-L, Broadcasting. And I opened that website up, and it turned out that they are the purveyors of a lot of the right-wing talk shows. They have a lot of great stuff, but they also purvey a lot of right, and they are in 50 marketplaces in America, and they have Hannity, and Rush Limbaugh goes out over ABC affiliates and all that. So, and they own ABC and the affiliates, they own ABC News and all that. And then I kept on reading, and it turned out that they were a subsidiary of another company called Frostman Little, F-R-O-S-T-M-A-N-N. L-I-T-T-L-E, two words, Frostman Little. And I went to Google, and I put in Frostman Little, director, board of directors, and here's the names that came up. Colin Powell, Henry Kissinger, Donald Rumsfeld, George Shultz, and Newt Gingrich was advisor to the board. That's the military-industrial complex there.
And Harvey, yes. And, I can't corroborate your details on that, but I'll tell you, here's another source for you if you want to dig even a little deeper. Go to They Rule. THEYRULE.net.
TheyRule.net. And the guy who put this thing together has done just a brilliant job of you can plug in any two major U.S. corporations. I think he's got like the top 100 corporations or the top 200 corporations, all the media companies, whatnot. You can plug in the two corporations, and it'll show you graphically all the members of the board, of the boards of directors, and link them together. And you can create a round robin. In my book on equal protection, I actually had a 100-company round robin that connects AT&T back to AT&T. And in the process, it goes through Coke, it goes through all the military contractors, it goes through all the media companies, it goes, I mean, it's just a giant circle. And it turns out that you find that there's a relatively small handful of people who are on a large number of very, very large boards. And the interlocking boards in the United States is something that I know would have made Teddy Roosevelt absolutely crazy. So, Harvey, check that out, too. TheyRule.net. It'll blow your mind. Gail in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Gail, what's up?
Hi. Just some opinion and observation. Earlier it was on the robber barons.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Cleveland, which was very much robber baron territory.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of nifty stuff that was left. The Symphony Hall is Severance Hall. Mm-hmm. And there are wonderful parks that were estates,
mm-hmm.
or there were. I left when I was 18,
yeah.
and I have only gone back to visit. But what they had working to make them a little more decent was social pressure. They wanted to be received as being the right sort of people, mm-hmm. and so they put on a little bit of a...
So they did some philanthropy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the current style is that who cares? What, I mean, criminals are hot social items. People who have nothing to offer but money or...
Yeah, it's the synthesis of celebrity having its own value. You know, the Paris Hiltons and Michelle Malkins of the world, people who really are not producing anything of consequence or value, but have been able to achieve celebrity status and therefore are, you know, you go to them simply because they're celebrity. And, you know, the celebration of celebrity on the one hand and the whole Reaganomics, greed is good, the whole change really that happened in the 1980s from 200 years of the values, I was quoting from the Constitutional Convention a little earlier, from 200 years of the values of egalitarianism and equality in the United States and a large middle class and not having a ruling class, essentially, an economic and political ruling class, to the idea of celebrating a ruling economic and political class. You're right, absolutely right, Gail, and it's a tragedy for the country, and it's one of, and that's why they're pushing back so hard on the inheritance tax. And the inheritance tax is the estate tax, something put into place by Teddy Roosevelt to stop the growth of the robber barons, of families that were so powerful that they could influence government. As Thomas Jefferson said, we can't have wealth so great that it can influence the state, because then you won't have over the long term, you won't have a democratic republic. And that's where we're at today. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Just a further comment on your topic on the news and what's going on with news in America.
Mm-hmm.
It just always amazed me that we could have this morality clause in here and have the FCC pursue pornography or the briefest glimpse, as in the Super Bowl and Janet Jackson incident.
Right, and that wasn't even a briefest glimpse, by the way. She was wearing a pasty.
Exactly. But here we have CBS going out and actually doctoring an interview with John McCain and editing out his gaffes. I mean, how is this possible that it's okay to lie if you want to protect morality? And we could take the same thing in advertising. You can't lie. I can't sell you a stick of gum unless I tell the truth. I can't, you know, lie and say it's going to make you lose 50 pounds if you chew one stick overnight. But in the political advertising, Karl Rove jumps up and calls it the criminalization of politics. I mean, these are the most important things, the most important moralities in this country.
Yeah.
Being told the truth, I mean, that used to be a high moral.
Here's the problem, Dave. Here's the problem. In the Buckley versus Vallejo or Vallejo decision, and to some extent in the First National Bank versus Bilotti decisions, the Supreme Court grappled with this. First of all, the First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech was really intended above all other forms of speech to protect political speech. That's the most important kind of free speech in a free society. And I think we all agree on that, right, left, and in between. So who's the arbiter of what's the truth? Because my truth and Sean Hannity's truth, or Rush Limbaugh, since he's the guy I go up against, you know, in the same time period, my truth and Rush Limbaugh's truth are quite different. And actually, we both might be able to marshal facts to defend our truths.
How about a disclaimer? Just the fact that this is opinion. I mean, on the stock shows, when Jim Cramer comes on, there's a massive disclaimer. When a radio station runs a paid advertisement, there's a massive disclaimer in front of that. How about, I'd like to see a nice disclaimer in front of Bill O'Reilly.
Yes. Beware, watching may cause intelligence to drop suddenly.
Or at least these are the opinions of Bill O'Reilly.
Right, right.
Not necessarily the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, when we in journalism in elementary school, we all had to write little things and practice, you know, putting that this is opinion and this is fact.
That's right. Yeah, and that's the thing: the who, what, when, where, how, and why. And Ron Suskind did a great job of that on my show. Dave, thanks for the call. You know, I twice was essentially asking him to draw a conclusion, and he just said, "I don't go there. I'm a journalist. I'll tell you the facts. You can draw your own damn conclusions." And of course, as a talk show host, that's my job, is to draw conclusions. I say Butch is a criminal.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer, Sean Taylor, our executive producer, to Chris Rosen and Lauren Kirshner and Marcus Hillman at Air America in New York, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to all of our affiliates, to our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. And thanks so much to Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for coming on our show every day and educating us about what's going on in the world. It's so cool to have an actual accredited White House reporter, congressional reporter, UN reporter, Pentagon, everything else. The people who actually ask the hard questions of the talking heads and of the politicians in Washington, D.C. Ellen, great to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Today, the Security Council, UN Security Council, is actually doing a 3 p.m. Meeting about the situation in Georgia. Today, the Georgian president got on CNN. He asked the United States for help. He said that Russia had invaded Georgia this morning, and he said that the area that they invaded, there was the overall population was less than 25,000 people, had never been more than 30,000. The real issue is that this whole thing is about oil.
Yeah, let me give a little backstory here to our listeners who may not be, because I haven't mentioned this story yet today, and I probably should have earlier on. Georgia is one of the former Soviet states. It borders southern Russia. It has a northern border with Russia. That border has been in dispute for 1,000 years, parts of that border. And in fact, Georgia itself has been at various times broken up and put back together again. But most importantly, the president of Georgia and you'll have to remind me of his name.
I cannot pronounce his name. It's similar to Shali Kashvili, but it's not.
Anyhow, I don't have it in front of me.
Shali Kashvili, but
there you go. In any case, the president of Georgia has asked to become a member of NATO and has been very pro-American. Now, if NATO had said, fine, you're now a NATO country, this invasion by Russia would spark World War III. We would right now be at war with Russia. And that's how serious this could be. And
it's very serious.
And Russia is saying that these insurgents, these actually it started out these pro Russian insurgents in this region in northern Georgia, who want to be affiliated with Russia rather than with Georgia. They attacked some Georgian forces, and then the Georgian forces went in to put down the rebellion, as it were, and the Russians said, hey, this is a provocation against us, and so they came in. If I have the story line right, that's my understanding of it.
Right. But the real issue, of course, is that there is this Baku pipeline, the main export pipeline, from the Caspian through Turkey to the Mediterranean. And then there would be this parallel gas pipeline from Turkmenistan. And then what they're going to happen is that wherever, according to some of the websites I've been reading, that there's a parallel gas pipe that once these pipelines are built, it's going to sort of create winners and losers in this multinational competition. And the Russians want to have the stranglehold on the gas, oil and gas resources.
Right.
And this would influence this would weaken the influence of Russia. And this is really what it's about.
Any sense, any gossip even, about where George W. Bush and Condi Rice, as our Secretary of State, are at on this? I mean, this is a war.
Has completely supported the president
of Georgia.
Yeah. And Condoleezza Rice was there, I think, pretty recently. And so what you have here is a situation where, you know, it's another proxy.
Yeah. It's Saakashvili.
Okay. You're better at pronunciation.
Mikhail Saakashvili.
You have a much better command of the English language than I do. You're the writer. I'm
this is the Georgian language. But in any case, yeah. So, George Bush, in so many ways, I mean, looking into the eyes of Vladimir Putin and declaring him a blood brother, you know, saying that he's seen his soul and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Putin this morning said war has started. And Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, says that this was a well-planned invasion and accused Russia of a well-planned invasion. This is from the New York Times.
Of course it's well-timed, and I think Putin is over at the Olympics and apparently had lunch with the president today.
Oh, that's very interesting. See, my guess of what's going to happen is the Bush is just going to roll over. They're going to let Georgia lose part of their territory and maybe even the entire nation to avoid any kind of conflict with Russia. And whoever is the next president is going to inherit an absolute mess in the Balkans and with regard to NATO. And if it's John McCain, it could be a very dangerous mess, because the guy is kind of hot-headed and not all that smart, frankly, about these kinds of international issues. If it's Barack Obama, I would think that, you know, we might see the very real possibility of some sort of a negotiated, you know, some sort of a diplomatic solution to this that actually restores some semblance of democracy to Georgia, but to those parts of Georgia that are now being invaded. But we'll see. We'll see. Ellen, half a minute left here to wrap up.
Okay,
the
other big issue, well, it's not so big, and that is that they are definitely going to have Cheney speak on the opening night of the Republican convention. Same night Bush speaks. Don't forget, that's Monday night of Labor Day. Don't think too many people are going to be focused on those guys.
That's interesting. Well, I'll be there, and you'll be there. So.
Well, we have a great skybox. You and I will be watching, and I'm going to order a few little beers and some wine.
Okay, we'll have a fine time. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up Monday, we're going to be talking about tax rebates and the best of the rest of the news, and it's just going to be a great day. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. Show up. See you on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmannRadio.com.